This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It wasn't necessarily the wisest decision to go to Iraq in May 2003, hoping to set up an English language magazine without any experience in a war zone, without even press credentials. But the 22-year-old David Enders didn't let that stop him. He and a small group of young Brits and Iraqis succeeded in publishing the Baghdad Bulletin. The first edition came out in June 2003, then it was published twice a month for a total of 7 issues. Enders has continued to report from Baghdad for The Nation and Mother Jones. Now he has a new book about his experiences in Iraq called The Baghdad Bulletin. I asked him why he wanted to publish a magazine in Baghdad.
I was studying in Beirut when the war began, and I was part of a group of American professors and students there that was very vocally demonstrating against the war. And when it happened anyway, we kind of looked around and we said, well, we can't really protest against a war that's already happened. What do we do? And one of my friends came up with this idea, well, we can go to Baghdad and actually see what's happening and bear witness and talk about it and tell people about it. So from a personal standpoint and with training as a journalist, that was what I wanted to do. I don't think any of us really had the notion that we were going to make money off this at any point. I mean, we were our goal was sort of to run it in a break-even manner, and within a year or two to just turn the whole thing over to an Iraqi staff for production, and you know, we were working with a number of Iraqis to set this up in a way that they saw it as operational within Baghdad itself.
Now, you had edited your school paper at the University of Michigan, but you didn't have press credentials to get you into Iraq. So how did you get in?
Well, we went and got credentialed by the Jordanian Information Ministry. At that time, the only press credentials that the U.S. military had issued were issued in Kuwait before the invasion, basically for embedded reporters going into Iraq with the military. So when we got into Baghdad, there was no military. They weren't issuing credentials. They told us actually to make our own credentials in order to get into the country in the first place. Basically, we made letterhead that said Baghdad Bulletin and said we're starting a magazine and went to the Jordanian Ministry of Information, and they sort of, you know, rubber stamped. We were, you know, out of however many thousand journalists crossed the border that month, and you know, signed a release form that said we wouldn't hold the Jordanian government responsible for what happened to us once we crossed the border, and we were sort of gone.
So you describe that at one point you were in Lebanon standing in line for a visa, and online with you were a lot of Lebanese men who were going to Iraq to fight. How did you know that that's why they were going there, and did you overhear what they were talking about, what their ambitions were?
Well, there were two lines, actually. There was a line for journalists, human shields, civilians who wanted to go to be aid workers, and then there was a line of people who were essentially going to fight, and that was a much longer and faster moving line. Those people seemed to be getting their visas stamped right away. No, we didn't really talk too much to the men. My friends who were with me were kind of frightened and disgusted by the whole thing. But I actually ended up helping a guy cut out a passport photo who was missing all his fingers on one hand, so he needed me to help him cut out his passport photo, and we sort of just didn't ask what that guy planned to do. But I think the Lebanese government said about 3,000 Lebanese went before the war, and only a few hundred of them came back. So if that gives any idea of what those men were headed out to do.
Even if you opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, was it not a little unsettling and perhaps even upsetting to be standing online next to a lot of men who were going there to fight American soldiers?
No. I guess I kind of maintained a sense of neutrality in that situation.
Would you compare for us what your goals were with Baghdad Bulletin and what the reality was of what you were able to actually cover?
Well, our goals were to sort of close this massive information gap between the Iraqi population and, you know, this new population of invaders, occupiers, liberators, whatever you wanted to call them, that had suddenly been thrust into the country. And we were publishing in Arabic and English and sort of trying to provide local reportage that would be accessible both to these people who are sort of now in control of the situation, and also for Iraqis who by and large didn't really have any way to express themselves, at least in English, and often had no idea what was happening. There were little things, you know, we were able to put people in touch with different people, you know, either within the civilian administration or on the Iraqi side. And we were able to facilitate communication, but not on a grand scale, I don't think.
Did you feel like you were going into Baghdad politically neutral, or did you want your publication to have more of a politically engaged editorial stand?
Well, we definitely wanted a politically engaged editorial stand. That was one thing, and in conversations with activists I knew, this was something that we talked a lot about. And some other journalists gave us advice to not legitimize the occupation at all, to not, you know, quote occupation officials in the magazine. And this was something that very quickly we looked at and said, well, this is ridiculous. It's whether anyone likes it, the military is here, this is the way things are running, let's deal with reality. So in that sense, we really wanted to have the views of all. We invited, you know, people from the CPA to write opinion essays and to write guest pieces for the magazine, because they were doing very little to publish their own statements and decrees. And what we kept on hearing from Iraqis, what are they saying? What are they doing? What's happening? And so, you know, being careful not to be seen as an organ of that body, or is related, we still wanted to be able to report on what they were doing.
How did you get the money to start the Baghdad Bulletin, and at what point did you actually get the money?
Well, Rafe Hassel, who I was studying with, the American University of Beirut, he's British, just had a friend, actually from school, who agreed off the bat to put up about $15,000 for the startup money, essentially family money, and he just thought it was a worthwhile thing that we were trying to do. And we got most of the money, I think, a few weeks after I first went to Baghdad and initially just sort of moved around to see if it was possible to do what we wanted to do.
And you decided it was? $15,000 doesn't get you very far, does it?
No, it's less than the budget for a lot of magazine pieces. But we ran a very tight ship. None of the foreign staff was working for pay. We were supplying room and board. But the Iraqi staff, we were the only paid staff members. And initially, we were able to operate at very low cost because things weren't terribly expensive in the country, and we managed to get in there before people really started taking advantage of what they could charge foreigners. And so I think we rented a three-bedroom house for about $180 a month. We bought a car for $1,000 in Jordan. And we were able to run off that money. We also made money selling advertising, but it never was quite enough to break even. So even with that limited budget, we were still able to put out 7 issues.
One of the places that you lived in Baghdad while publishing the Baghdad Bulletin was right across the street from the Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani, who is now the president of the transitional government.
Correct.
And one of the things you did was borrow power from his generator during power outages. So how did you strike up a relationship with him?
Well, we never actually met Talabani. We met his son. We actually struck up a relationship sort of with the people in the house. When we first got in there, there was an Iraqi guy I knew who was living in Beirut. He said, well, my parents have a house in Baghdad they haven't lived in 2 decades, but, you know, my aunt and uncle keep an eye on it. If you guys need a place to stay, you can go crash there. And so we ended up sort of camped out in the living room of this big, huge, kind of Vegas-style house in Mansour, which is one of the richer areas of Baghdad. And part of the reason we felt comfortable doing that and felt safe was because we were directly across the street, it turned out, from Jalal Talabani, who had sort of taken over this house and had quite a large number of guards stationed in the neighborhood and at different exits and entrances to the neighborhood and, of course, around the house. And we met Anne Cluid, who is a British member of parliament. She was Tony Blair's human rights envoy to Iraq. And so we actually met her one day standing outside on the street, and she kind of took us around the house. And and introduced this to different people. We never did meet Mr. Talabani, like I said, and we kept on bugging his son about the possibility of hooking up to their generator. They had a very large generator, and this was a point when the electricity was probably on for like 4 hours a day. And eventually we noticed that the guard at our house and sort of the groundskeeper had already gone ahead and stolen a line from the generator across the street. So Mark Gordon James, the financial manager for the magazine, sort of wired a line into that using, you know, one of those like power strips, basically, and wrapped a bunch of duct tape around it. That's pretty much how everything was done at that point, and in a lot of ways is still being done. Every neighborhood in Baghdad is full of these crisscrossed wires. Most neighborhoods have purchased a generator and sort of share it to deal with the outages.
One of the writers who was writing for Baghdad Bulletin was killed in Baghdad. His name was Richard Wilde. He was 24. What happened to him?
He was not writing for us. Richard was a filmmaker working in the UK, I believe for Channel 4. I had only corresponded with him over email. He and Mark Gordon James, our business manager, had mutual friends in London, and he emailed us and said, "I'd like to come out. Do you guys have room?" And at that point, we had, you know, we were looking at sending foreign staff home. And we said, "Well, you know, we can't offer you a place, but when you get out here, you know, look us up, maybe you can write something for us, but definitely, you know, come say hello and let's talk, and you know, it's just good to know who's out there." And Richard was, I think, 24 or 25 at the time. And the day we were supposed to meet him, he was killed. He was shot in the back of the head outside one of the museums in Baghdad, I believe it was the Natural History Museum. And the circumstances surrounding the death are still unclear. And what that did was sort of throw us into these kind of, at least our foreign staff was kind of thrown into this spasm of, well, this is, it made it very real for the young Brits who were out there with me, I think. Because that was the first time, you know, this had happened to anyone who we knew. The reality of it sort of sunk in, I think, at that point.
Did you feel particularly bad because the Baghdad Bulletin might have been one of the things that inspired Richard Wilde to come to Iraq in the first place? Were you worried that the publicity you were getting would inspire young people to go there who might get killed?
Well, certainly. And I mentioned it in the book. There was a story, I think, on Marketplace that referred to us as hipsters. And after we kind of had a good laugh about it, we go, "What the, you know, what are hipsters doing in a war zone? That's not, you know, how we're intending to market ourselves." And then the flip side was, well, we are 20-somethings with virtually no experience. Who are we to tell people not to come out? You know, we don't really know much more than them, other than we've been on the ground for a few months. So that was sort of a real serious concern, and that was, you know, any time we talked to someone who we considered bringing out or who wanted to come out, we made that very clear that there were no guarantees we could make on safety. Everybody was out there entirely of their own volition, and of course, you know, obviously free to leave at any time, and knew what they were doing. These were issues that of course came up frequently.
Why did you decide to end publication of the Baghdad Bulletin after 7 editions?
The reason that we decided to close was shortly after the UN bombing, which happened as we were working on production of our last issue. And in the issue, we had a story by one of our British staff members, and she was talking to the security guards at the UN who were complaining that their security concerns were being downplayed because of the political situation. They said they were in imminent danger of being attacked, and they were quite concerned. And a few days later, the UN headquarters, the Canal Hotel, which was very close to our house, was bombed, virtually demolished. And it became very evident to us based you know, on what we were writing about and events like the UN bombing and the Red Cross bombing shortly thereafter, that no one in the country was safe, no matter what they were doing. It was very easy to look at the guerrillas attacking military targets and say, okay, this is, you know, a guerrilla war. They're attacking military targets. We can consider ourselves relatively safe and not be terribly concerned. So at that point, we sort of saw the rules changing. And from where we were standing, it made more sense to close shop before we were one of those stories.
Ideally, you wanted to sell the Baghdad Bulletin after you decided to fold it, so that it wouldn't really fold. Somebody else would carry it
right.
on.
Right, we looked at that possibility.
That. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, what we kept getting were offers to turn it into a business magazine. We would get these people who said, well, we're setting up an international trade fair in Baghdad in 2 months. And we would, you know, love someone to advertise this. Can you guys do like a 30-page, you know, ad mag, basically, for what we're doing for Reconstruction? And that was, of course, you know, the shortest way to end up dead was to be seen as an American contractor, someone, you know, shilling for Halliburton or KBR or the military. And that was a situation that was just, you know, unacceptable from A, the principles we had tried to incorporate in setting up the magazine, and from a simple pragmatic standpoint of survival. And of course, the trade fair never happened in Baghdad.
You were like 22 or 23 when you first went to Baghdad?
22.
So was it any, did that make it any more difficult to get taken seriously as a journalist and publisher?
To some extent. I think a lot of the media covered it from the angle of, there are a bunch of kids in Baghdad. How about this? So people tended to kind of, you know, see it as a bit of an idealistic, in some cases, maybe even a joke. And at one point, we went to, you know, we started asking different journalists for advice. We went to DFID, which is like USAID, for the British government. We never considered trying to find American funding, but we did talk to the British government about it, and got sort of laughed out of the embassy by this woman who goes, "Oh, it's cute. You kids are trying to start a newspaper," and in one sense it kind of hurt, and in another sense it really spurred us on to say, "Well, what do these people know? We'll go ahead and do it anyway." And I think with Iraqis it really helped. I think people really appreciated it. You know, here was a young American who was not in uniform trying to do something. Here were young British kids trying to do something.
Did you feel any connection to the American soldiers in Iraq through your age? You were about 22, and a lot of the soldiers were in their teens or early 20s.
Definitely. And even now, this most recent trip, I almost started to feel old hanging out with the soldiers. That's one thing that I think you don't have a lot of people who are in the same cohort covering these guys. You know, you go out and you see like a 45 or 50-year-old hack hanging out with these guys, and it's like, well, the generational references are different. You just have such a broad gap. It's really easy for me to sort of fall in with these guys and just hang out and, you know, talk about skateboarding or whatever. So I think that definitely kind of allowed me to speak on a different level with these guys and to sort of, you know, see where they were coming from in a way.
Well, David Enders, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Enders' new book is called Baghdad Bulletin.